So the garages are open, the hardware stores, the phone shops, the opticians, the dentists are opening again this week for routine treatment. So we are seeing a small return to normality. But what could the legal implications be? Not just for the employer, but also for the employees. You know, this return to work safety protocol, we had Minister Richard Bruton with us last Thursday, going through a whole range of issues and measures that businesses, if you're not opening in phase one, you should be getting ready for phase two, three, four and five in the weeks ahead. So are there legal implications that none of us are really aware of? Well, I'm joined on the programme this morning by Brian Gill. He is a partner at Callan Tansey Solicitors. Brian, thanks for joining us. Good morning to you.
Good morning, Tommy, and good morning to your listeners as well.
So, the legal implications, I suppose, it's the furthest thing from all of our minds, but taking it from the perspective of the employer, what could go wrong?
Well, lots of things can go wrong, Tommy, and the first thing that the employer has to realise is that they need to know what they know about the law, and secondly, they need to know what they don't know, but where they can find the answers. So for every employer, I completely appreciate that it may be the last thing on their mind, and they may say to themselves, I just need to get the door open, I need to keep the business afloat, I need to keep cash flow coming in and cash flow going, and the last thing on my mind is whether or not I have some obscure arcane law or some other state authority looking over my shoulder to see am I doing everything absolutely right. I just need to get open and stay open for my clients, my customers and my family. And I accept that, that's absolutely right. But in order to sustain yourself long term and in order to minimise the risks, it really is critical that employers are aware of what their legal obligations are. And the starting point for all of those are two documents that every employer should have up and down the region, from Mullet Moor down to Ballindine, from Torristown right over to Belmullet. Every single employer must have two key documents. They need to have a risk assessment done on their business. The law provides that they have to have those done. And secondly, they have to have a safety statement. The safety statement is their plan of action based on the risks that they've identified in their risk assessment. And the COVID crisis has simply added another threat and therefore another series of risks. So what every employer will be doing is they're going to be building on their risk assessment and they're going to be building on their safety statement in relation to the COVID crisis.
But is that, and I don't want to frivolize this, but I mean, is that not just a case of putting in that now within our company we have a protocol in place to deal with any pandemic or any, you know, unforeseen disease that may occur in this country? Full stop. Is that enough?
No, it is not, Tommy. It's far from enough. So your starting point is, as I said, those two documents, the risk assessment, the safety statement. They have to be detailed. You have to build in the risks in relation to the specific pandemic regarding corona crisis. The three particular requirements to slow the spread of the virus must inform every step that you take: the hand hygiene, the respiratory etiquette, and the physical distancing. When you have that piece in place, you then take out your contracts or your terms and conditions of employment. Again, legal obligation for every employer in the region to have those in place. You look at those, you see what are the specific terms that apply to my employees and what terms might have to change as I bring people back to work. What terms have to stay the same? Where do I have leeway to change and where do I not have leeway? What particular terms do I need to get the employees' consent on and which ones can I go ahead with?
But is a contract not a contract? So that if the employer decides, well, look, I want to change the terms and conditions of this contract, can the employer simply say, well, with respect, there's no condition in that contract to say that it can be changed. So, sorry, we leave things as they are.
Well, first of all, it depends, and without wishing to fudge it, Tommy, it depends on what the contract specifically says on any clause in relation to hours of work or time of work. But if you're going to make a change, those changes need to be with the consent of the employee. However, it may well be that you're facing a far greater risk in terms of the actual sustainability of the business, in which case it's beyond an individual employee and you're looking about saving it. So you may have to be looking at issues such as redundancies, which will potentially override any individual contract. But again, even with redundancies and with layoffs and short terms, the first port of call for every single employer is what is in the contract that I have. That's my relationship, my legal relationship with my employee. That is what an employee will be entitled to rely on if, God forbid, any of these issues end up in an external forum, whether it's in the courts or any of the employment courts.
But if you say, for example, and I'm only taking this as an example, somebody owns a very small clothes shop and they have three full-time employees, and they know that it's going to be challenging to keep the business afloat, and they have decided, they've done a new projected budget plan for the year, and they know they have to get rid of one of the three staff. They want to get rid of staff member A, okay? But staff member A happens to be the longest person there. So is there a rule to say that it has to be the last in, first out, or can the employer make a case to say that, look, I'm getting rid of person A for the simple reason that I just want to get rid of person A?
Okay, can I make one preliminary point in relation to redundancies?
Yes.
Because it's very important from an employer perspective. It obviously has consequences for the employee as well. Now, you may remember this from the previous crisis, which was an altogether different crisis. It was mostly an economic crisis back in 2009, 2010. There was at least anecdotal evidence, some evidence of substance, that employers were using the downturn as a means of making certain employees redundant. So that's an absolute no-no from an employment law point of view. So using a crisis to say, I need to reduce my numbers. But let's take it that that's not the case, and there is a genuine redundancy situation. And bear in mind that in a redundancy, it's not the individual at all. It's the job that's being made redundant. So there is no need for that job anymore. Again, it's back to the contract. What is in the contract in relation to the process that the employer is going to use? You have to have a matrix. In other words, you have to have a set of indicators or a set of criteria by which you select an individual's job for redundancy. There's a whole series of things, one of which may be the length of service. But it's only one. It may be last in, first out. But if it's last in, first out, and that's the custom and practice that the business has, that's what you have to apply in this particular instance. You cannot depart from it unless you have good objective reasons for departing from it. So again, I would counsel caution to any employer to be taking decisions based on an individual factor that either isn't in a contract or doesn't form part of the custom and practice. Now, maybe for many employers, this is the first time they've ever had to face that situation. So obviously it's what's in the contract. You cannot discriminate against any employees. So you need to have reasons that are objectively justifiable. And that may be a particular factor in one business. It may be another factor in another business.
Of course, there's also the situation where a lot of employers don't have the money to pay redundancies.
Well, again, this is what happened previously. In other words, to put off the fateful day of having to bite the bullet and make a position redundant and therefore let go certain employees, employers were putting people on short time and putting them on layoffs indefinitely as a means of avoiding having to make redundancy payouts. Now, if it's a case that a redundancy is warranted and it has to be genuine and there can be nothing about the redundancy which relates back to the individual, but let's take it that it's a genuine redundancy, if all the person can afford is the state the minimum, which is 2 weeks per year of service up to a maximum of €600 plus a bonus week, then that's all that the person is entitled to get. And depending on the financial circumstances of the employer, it may be that a particular employer might be able to supplement that with an ex gratia payment. But their legal obligation is quite clear as to what the statutory minimum is they have in a redundancy situation.
All right, I really haven't given this lot enough time, but one thing that is coming through loud and clear, the number of calls we're getting since you came on air from people who are employed who are saying they have no contract.
Yeah,
is
incredible.
That doesn't surprise you, does it?
Not at all. Not in the slightest.
So that's to the
benefit. No-brainer.
That's to the benefit of the employer, isn't it?
Not particularly, Tommy.
No.
That's not to say it shouldn't be done, because legally there's an obligation under acts going back as far as 1994, the Terms of Employment Information Act, Section 3 in that act states very specifically what the terms and conditions that have to be in writing and have to be given to an employee. So that's 26 years ago. That obligation is in place. So there is no excuse for an employer not to give an employee written terms and conditions. Whether you call it a contract of employment or whether you don't, if those written terms have been given over, then you've met your obligations. There is no excuse for not having it done in 2020.
Okay, all right. So overall, what are you saying, Brian, to employers today? Get your acts together, make sure your risk assessment, your safety statements are updated, and have conversations with staff members if you believe there could be issues down the line in terms of redundancies, etc.
A couple of comments then to close off, Tommy. One, the key pillars in rebuilding your business: communication, collaboration. When it comes to the law, know what you know what you don't know, and know where you can find the answers. Go back to your contract, go back to your risk assessment, go back to your safety statement. If you don't have those three, get them, and get them as quickly and as properly. If you need to get external advice in relation to do that. It's actually an investment rather than a cost. And the last three reasons, Tommy, as to why we should do any of this, really, from an employer's perspective, I suppose there's three reasons. First and foremost, it can and it probably will save lives. Two, it'll increase your business's prospects of surviving the crisis. And number three, it'll help to prevent you coming into a legal forum, whether it's the Workplace Relations Commission's or court, having to explain why you didn't take these actions. And that will cost you in the long run. It'll cost you financially, and it will cost your reputation across the region if you don't do it.
Okay.
Which is the last thing businesses need at this point in time.
All right, well, it's food for thought, that is for sure. Somebody has just texted and say, why is it that solicitors always sound like they're making great sense? Well, you're certainly making great sense this morning. And for employers out there, there's a lot to be digested, but it's important that you don't, as they say, bury your head in the sand. Get yourself sorted. And if you need advice, where is the best place to find all this information in one fell swoop?
Like a lot of things nowadays, the internet, there are a lot of government publications online. So basically, the Department of Business and Social Affairs, but Heather Humphrey's department, Minister Humphrey's, her department have rolled out quite a number of, self-help documents, for want of a better phrase, where you can find out exactly what you need, your local intro office.
Okay.
And also there are local citizens information advice centres.
They have it as well. Great. Brian, listen, good to talk to you, and thank you so much for joining us today.
You're very welcome, Tommy.
All right, have a good
day.
And
all the best to your employees and employers across the region.
Thanks a lot. That's Brian Gill there, who is a partner at Callan Tansey Solicitors.